years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m.
From New York and Los Angeles, this is Democracy Now!
I think it's close to over, yeah. I mean, I view it as very close to over. You know what? If I pulled up stakes right now, it would take them 20 years to rebuild that country. And we're not finished.
As President Trump claims once again that the war in Iran is almost over, we'll look at the U.S. blockade of Iranian ports and Iran's threats to retaliate by disrupting shipping in the Red Sea and the Sea of Oman. We'll get the latest. Then to Sudan.
It marks 3 years since the war in Sudan began. It is a tragic milestone in the conflict that has shattered a country of immense promise and created the world's largest humanitarian crisis.
And finally, into the wood chipper, a whistleblower's account of how the Trump administration shredded U.S. aid. We'll speak to a former USAID official about the inside story of what happened when Elon Musk and Doge dismantled the agency. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. The Senate has rejected a resolution seeking to rein in President Trump's ability to wage war against Iran. On Wednesday, all Senate Republicans, except for Kentucky's Rand Paul, voted against the War Powers resolution, which failed in a vote of 47 to 52. Every Democrat, except Pennsylvania's John Fetterman, voted in favor of it. The House is set to vote on a similar measure this afternoon. Meanwhile, senators voted down a pair of resolutions seeking to halt the sale of armored bulldozers, 1,000-pound bombs, and other hardware to Israel's military, despite Israel's repeated use of U.S. weapons to commit war crimes. The resolutions were sponsored by Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders.
Israel did not have the right to violate international law and wage an all-out war of unspeakable destruction against the entire Palestinian people in what experts have correctly concluded is a genocide.
40 of the Senate's 47 Democrats voted for at least one of Sanders' two resolutions. The seven Democrats who sided with Senate Republicans in opposition are Richard Blumenthal, Chris Coons, Catherine Cortez Masto, John Fetterman, Kirsten Gillibrand, Jackie Rosen, and Chuck Schumer, the Democratic minority leader. The nonprofit A New Policy, which was founded by former State Department officials who resigned in protest of U.S. policies in Israel, said Wednesday's vote shows for the first time that an overwhelming majority of Senate Democrats oppose unconditional aid to Israel. They added, quote, "American politics are changing and eventually American policies will follow," unquote. Iran's military warned Wednesday it will expand its blockade of the Strait of Hormuz to include the Sea of Oman and the Red Sea unless the United States ends its naval blockade of Iranian ports. Iran's threat of escalation came as U.S. Central Command said its naval forces have completely halted trade going in and out of Iran by sea, with at least 10 vessels forced to turn around so far. Meanwhile, the White House said it was optimistic about continuing negotiations between the U.S. and Iran after a high-level Pakistani delegation arrives in Tehran seeking to lay the groundwork for a second round of talks with the U.S. Pakistani officials said they're expecting a, quote, major breakthrough, while a spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry said he remains skeptical.
It remains to be seen to what extent the other side is truly serious about the claims they've made regarding diplomacy. It is the Americans who must prove their seriousness, because they have not only failed to adhere to their commitments many times, but have also fundamentally destroyed the negotiating table.
In southern Lebanon, at least 20 people were killed in Israeli strikes on Wednesday, just one day after Lebanese and Israeli envoys held the first direct talks between the two countries in more than three decades. Among the dead were four paramedics killed in a so-called triple-tap strike while on an emergency rescue mission. This comes as a senior Lebanese security official tells Reuters that an Israeli strike has severed the last bridge linking southern Lebanon to the rest of the country. Lebanon's health ministry reports at least 2,167 people have been killed and more than 7,000 wounded in Israeli strikes since March 2nd. More than 1.2 million people, including 350,000 children, have been forced to flee their homes. This is Wael Sabah, who lost his mother and brother in an Israeli strike.
Nobody should have to go through this. And unfortunately, my brother, sister, and I are not the only ones that are going through this. Hundreds, if not thousands, on that day of families are mourning in the same way that I am.
In the Gaza Strip, Palestinians held a funeral procession Wednesday for five people killed in an Israeli airstrike near a camp in Al-Shati refugee camp, in a cafe in an Al-Shati refugee camp in western Gaza City.
We are also human beings, and we have the right to live. We love life. We are not terrorists, as the occupation claims, but the world's silence is what gave the occupation an excuse to continue killing us daily.
Earlier today, an Israeli drone strike near a school in Bat Lehia killed two brothers. Palestinian health officials say the latest killings bring the death toll from Israeli attacks to 767 since a U.S. brokered ceasefire was supposed to have taken effect last October. The U.S. military says it struck an alleged drug vessel in the eastern Pacific on Wednesday, killing three people. The Pentagon offered no evidence that the boat was carrying drugs, describing those killed as, quote, narco-terrorists. On Tuesday, a similar U.S. strike against an alleged drug boat in the eastern Pacific killed four people, while a strike Monday killed two people, according to the U.S. military. The latest strikes bring the Pentagon's claimed death toll to at least 178 since the operations began in the eastern Pacific and the Caribbean last September. At least 53 vessels have been targeted. International legal experts and human rights groups say the strikes amount to extrajudicial killings. House Democrats have filed six articles of impeachment against Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. The articles were introduced by Democratic Congressmember Yasemin Ansari of Arizona. The articles accuse Hegseth of running an unauthorized war against Iran without congressional approval, committing violations of the law of armed conflict, including the bombing of a girls' school in Minab, Iran, the reckless handling of sensitive military information in connection with the Signalgate scandal, obstructing congressional oversight, the abuse of power and politicization of the armed forces, and engaging in conduct bringing disrepute upon the U.S. armed forces. At least eight Democratic lawmakers have signed on as co-sponsors, but the measure has virtually no chance of passing given the current Republican majority in Congress. Congressmember Ansari said in a statement, quote, "Only Congress has the power to declare war, not a rogue president or his lackeys." A new analysis by The Guardian finds that the world's top 100 oil and gas companies banked more than $30 million in windfall profits per hour in the first month of the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran. Saudi Aramco, Gazprom, and ExxonMobil are among the biggest beneficiaries. Collectively, oil and gas companies stand to make $234 billion by the end of the year if oil prices continue to average $100 per barrel. Meanwhile, dozens of countries face budget shortfalls after cutting fuel taxes to help struggling consumers. In southern Turkey, a 14-year-old armed with five guns and seven magazines opened fire inside a middle school on Wednesday, killing at least nine people and wounding 13 others before reportedly taking his own life. The attacker used weapons taken from his father, a former police officer. Mass shootings are extremely rare in Turkey, which has strict gun control laws. However, Wednesday's massacre was the second school shooting in just 48 hours. A day earlier, 16 people were injured when a former student opened fire in a high school elsewhere in southern Turkey. This is an eyewitness.
He was a kid about 17 or 18 years old who suddenly walked through the school's front door. He just started shooting directly at whoever came in front of him from inside, and then all the students and teachers started screaming and everyone scattered in different directions.
Meanwhile, in Oklahoma, Paul's Valley High School principal Kirk Moore suffered a gunshot wound last week after tackling a 20-year-old armed with two semi-automatic handguns. No students were injured and the man was arrested. Prosecutors say he sought to carry out a mass shooting like the 1999 Columbine High School massacre. According to the Gun Violence Archive, the U.S. has logged 106 mass shootings since January 1st, an average of one per day. A federal jury in Manhattan found Wednesday that Live Nation and its subsidiary Ticketmaster operated as a monopoly that harmed consumers and overcharged ticket buyers. 33 states and the District of Columbia sued Live Nation, arguing that the company used threats and retaliation to pressure artists and venues into using their services, including withholding lucrative concert tours from venues that did not sign exclusive deals with Ticketmaster. A judge will hold a second trial to determine whether to order a breakup of the company. Live Nation plans to appeal. And thousands of people took to the streets and cities across the U.S. on Wednesday, Tax Day, protesting the use of their tax dollars to fund wars, genocide, and immigration enforcement. The nationwide day of action included demonstrations in New York, Washington, D.C., Chicago, San Francisco, Dallas, and elsewhere. It was organized by the U.S. Palestinian Community Network and Taxpayers Against Genocide and endorsed by a broad coalition of civil society groups, including the Council on American Islamic Relations. Meanwhile, New York Governor Kathy Hochul has proposed an annual tax on second homes in New York City that are worth $5 million or more. Mayor Zohran Mamdani is backing the measure. In a Tax Day message, Mamdani spoke outside the 24,000-square-foot Manhattan penthouse of hedge fund CEO Ken Griffin, which Griffin purchased for $230 million.
This is a fundamentally unfair system that hurts working New Yorkers. Now, it's coming to an end. This tax will raise at least $500 million directly for the city. It'll help fund things like free childcare, cleaner streets, and safer neighborhoods. As mayor, I believe everyone has a role to play in contributing to our city, and some a little bit more than others. Happy Tax Day, New York.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York.
And I am Amy Goodman in Los Angeles, here for the theatrical release of the documentary Steal This Story, Please, about 30 years of Democracy Now! We're doing fundraisers around the country for public media. Friday is for Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles at the Lemley Royal in West L.A. You can check our website at democracynow.org. We then head off to the Bay Area, San Francisco and Berkeley, and then to Seattle and Portland and beyond. Welcome to our listeners, readers and viewers around the country and around the world.
Iran's military says it will begin disrupting shipping in the Sea of Oman and the Red Sea if the United States does not end its naval blockade of Iranian ports. Iran's threat of escalation came as U.S. Central Command said U.S. forces have completely halted maritime trade to and from Iran, with at least 10 vessels forced to turn around. At a press conference today, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said the U.S. plans to enforce the blockade. Iran effectively closed the Strait of Hormuz in early March, disrupting global oil and trade markets. On Wednesday, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt was questioned about the Navy blockade of Iranian ports.
On Iran, is there a timeline for how long this blockade is going to remain in place in the Strait of Hormuz by the United States that President Trump has voiced to you or that you've heard among officials?
Sure. I will never set timelines on behalf of the President of the United States, but with respect to the blockade, as you know, it has been fully implemented, and it's being enforced against vessels of all nations entering or departing Iranian ports. I want to make that point clear. I've seen some misreporting on that as well. This includes all Iranian ports on the Arabian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman. And our U.S. forces in the region are supporting the freedom of navigation for vessels that are transiting the strait to and from non-Iranian ports. So I know some in the press were confused about that. We are supporting the freedom of navigation, just not with respect to any tanker or vessel that would benefit the economy of Iran as these negotiations continue.
Carolyn Leavitt went on to say that the White House is optimistic about continuing negotiations between the U.S. and Iran. On Wednesday, a high-level Pakistani delegation traveled to Tehran to lay the groundwork for a possible second round of talks. We go now to London, where we're joined by Leila Khalili. She's a professor of Gulf Studies at the University of Exeter and author of several books, including Extractive Capitalism, How Commodities and Cronyism Drive the Global Economy, as well as Sinews of War and Trade, Shipping and Capitalism in the Arabian Peninsula. I can't think of any time that your work was more relevant than now, Professor. Let's start off with this naval blockade of Iranian ports entering its fourth day. The blockade is being enforced, according to CENTCOM, by 10,000 U.S. troops, over a dozen warships, dozens of aircraft. Can you explain exactly what's happening? And for the geographically challenged, the difference between the Strait of Hormuz, the Persian Gulf, and how it's extending beyond to the Red Sea and the Sea of Oman?
Okay, thank you very much for having me on. And yes, sadly, this is a terrible way for my area of expertise to actually be of relevance. First, the geography of the area. The Persian or Arabian Gulf sits between Iran on the north, a sliver of Iraq on the west, and then the various countries that are known as emirates or kingdoms of the Gulf, Kuwait, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates around the southern shore of the Persian Gulf. At the narrowest bit where the Persian Gulf meets the Gulf of Oman on the other side, that's the Strait of Hormuz, which, depending on how you measure it, it's around 25 to 30 nautical miles. So the Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz lies in the north between Iran in the north and the Musandam Peninsula, which is an extension of Oman in the south. So in fact, the water of the Strait of Hormuz is divided between those. There is no high seas. This is territorial waters divided evenly between the two countries. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that, of course, Iran has basically lies on the entire northern shore of the Persian Gulf, but also the Gulf of Oman. So it does have capacities. In fact, one of Iran's big ports in which India invested, Chabahar, is in the eastern part of Iran, in the northern shore of the Gulf of Oman. The Red Sea is on the other side of the Arabian Peninsula. The Red Sea lies on the western shore of Saudi Arabia. And the way that Iran can disrupt trade in the Red Sea is through firing missiles, for example, as it has done already to the port of Yanbu, which is a oil lifting port for Saudi Arabia on the Red Sea, but also through possibly having its ally, the Ansar Allah of Yemen, which are otherwise also known as the Houthis, disrupting trade there as they did during the Israeli genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. But there are a couple of things about that blockade question that I think is really important to note. First of all, the U.S. claims to have stopped completely and totally the trade of oil out of Iran, or indeed has blockaded any kind of ships going to or from Iran. In fact, reporting from shipping companies that actually track this stuff comes back that in the 4 days since the blockade has started, somewhere between 14 to 15 ships have gone through the Strait of Hormuz, at least half of them to Iran. And the way that they have done so is either through routes that obviously the U.S. is incapable of or not particularly good at policing, through spoofing their automatic identification system. Spoofing is this process where the automatic identification system is essentially presented as somebody else's ID system, indicating a different country or different flag country for the ship. And or ships have gone dark, which is something that happens all the time. In fact, when I traveled on a freighter many years ago, 10, 11 years ago, one of the things that was most striking when going through the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, and indeed the Persian Gulf, was the extent to which warships, particularly US or the EU warships, actually turned off their AIS and went dark. So this is a practice, although a lot of people like to present it as some kind of a nefarious thing. If we are going to think of it as nefarious, in fact, a lot of ships take take part in this practice of going dark, including especially the United States. In fact, this is in the case of U.S. naval ships, has resulted in all sorts of problems, collisions, indeed, with U.S. Navy ships. Now, in terms of the actual blockade and the effects it's having, I was just looking at the Bloomberg today, and forgive me as I read this out, because it was really striking to me. Bloomberg, which is, of course, one of the most reliable financial reporting sites anywhere in the world, reports that we are moving from short-term jolt to long-term shock as the largest supply disruption in the history of the global oil market takes place. So this is what's happening, and obviously the blockade continues, because before the war, before the U.S. and Israeli war on Iran started on the 28th of February, somewhere between 140 to 170 ships a day were crossing the Strait of Hormuz. Now it's only 14 to 15. One of the things that this has meant is that about 10 million barrels per day of oil supply has been lost. This includes, although, of course, the primary people being punished by this shortage of oil are the economies in Asia. In fact, it actually also affects the United States, because some of the last ships that left the Persian Gulf before the war started were actually delivering their supplies now. So we are going to see the effects of the blockade in the coming week or two. Apparently one of these ships actually arrived in California, because unlike the rest of the United States, California actually does receive oil from the Middle East, and its refineries use a medium sour oil, a kind of a medium grade, and sour meaning high sulfur kind of oil that comes specifically from the Middle East. So the effects of this are, of course, being felt incredibly widely. Another really striking statistic was that an actual real world barrel of oil was sold in Sri Lanka at more than $280 a barrel. That is double what the price is going elsewhere in the world. So the effects of this are incredibly, incredibly striking. What the blockade might mean, of course, is that the U.S. will start firing on ships that it assumes are Iranian or carrying oil from Iran or other cargo to Iran. But of course, if it does so within the context of the ceasefire, it is violating the ceasefire. If it does so outside the context of ceasefire, Iran can interpret this as a belligerent action, because, of course, a blockade is exactly that, particularly as it is blockading Iran in its territorial waters. So the state that we're in is that, of course, we're not getting any reliable or credible kind of reporting from the Trump administration whatsoever. The state of play in the region, of course, is that Iran is going to defend itself against this imperial imposition, and how it's going to do that remains to be seen.
Lale, as you mentioned, despite the fact that the U.S. says that its blockade is entirely effective and no ships are getting through, at least 14 to 15 have got through, including several Iranian ships. Now, the Washington Post reported just yesterday that more troops are expected, U.S. troops are expected to arrive in the region, an additional 6,000 by To arrive soon, and 4,000 to arrive at the end of the month. I mean, if you could say something about what would make, I mean, whether those troops, and obviously this is speculation, whether they might help to impose a more total blockade, or, you know, how, where you see this going.
It's really difficult to say, again, in part because reporting on this war has been so drastically narrow and that there's so much misinformation coming from the United States and its allies in the region, both the Arab Gulf, Emirates, as well as Israel. And of course, there is little reporting that comes from the Iranian side that is completely and totally verifiable. There's an interest in by everybody to sort of not give the whole picture. In the case of the troops arriving, I wonder how many of those troops that are arriving were the troops that were on the way when a couple of weeks ago the U.S. declared that there was going to be airborne troops deployed to Iran. There's also some question for me, and it's not a question that only I'm asking. I'm really curious as to why the pilot that was downed, the two pilots that were ostensibly rescued a couple of weeks ago, have not appeared on any television shows. They have not been paraded around as such things are customary. And indeed, whether or not the story of pilot rescue was actually cover for a trial run of taking away Iran's uranium near Isfahan. So to me, it's unclear how the arrival even of another 15 or 20,000 troops are going to accomplish this, because in addition to obviously the troops arriving, you're going to need to have equipment arriving as well. You're going to have more ships, et cetera. And so this means repositioning basically the U.S. Naval posture, not just in the Gulf, but also elsewhere in the world as it shifts its ships to the region. This also indicates to some extent that perhaps what the aim of the Trump administration is to return to hostilities after the end of the ceasefire period. The problem with, of course, this is that there is so much the sort of the shock that we saw in the first couple of weeks of the war are going to only accelerate in a number of different areas. So obviously, about 10 million barrels per day of oil has been taken out of the market. But in addition to that, there was reporting today that there's going to be an incredible shortage of aluminium, as aluminium smelters in the Gulf have either been hit. And in one case, there was a very dramatically describing instance where an aluminium smelter in Abu Dhabi was hit and the actual molten aluminium froze in the pipes, they would have to basically replace a lot of the equipment in those. With aluminium, actually, prices at being at a 4-year high, as higher than it has ever been since the Russian war on Ukraine. There's also China has just banned the export of sulfuric acid, which is really incredibly necessary for the production both of fertilizer, but also much more significantly in the manufacturing of semiconductors. Helium reserves are down massively because, of course, Qatar was one of the world's biggest Ras Al Khaimah plant, was the world's single largest producer of helium, although the U.S. is the largest country producer of helium. And with helium amounts being down, semiconductor manufacturers, including chip makers for companies like, for example, NVIDIA, are concerned because, of course, helium goes to MRI machines and to chip makers. And of course, given the way that the market is so overblown and there's such a big bubble around AI, there's probably going to be a shift from using helium for MRI machines towards the chip makers, because, of course, that's going to be, you know, out to the profits in the pockets of the tech bros. And what that indicates, of course, is that this is going to also hit people really hard. So the effect of what the war is going to be is going to actually be felt even more strongly in the coming weeks, in both inflationary terms and the inflation in the price of petrol at the petrol pump, but also in other ways, because, of course, transportation costs are going to be higher. So food prices are going to be higher when people's MRIs are going to be scheduled out by 6 months or some such, when semiconductor manufacturing is going to be affected, this is going to be quite significant. The other factor in all of this, of course, is the question of insurance. And a lot of insurance providers have actually either suspended providing insurance to any ships in the whole of the Middle East region, the whole of the sort of region surrounding the Arabian Peninsula, or have increased their war risk premium incredibly in a very kind of dramatic sort of way. Now, the U.S. has kind of promised since the beginning of the war that it is going to cover the insurance, be a kind of a backstop for insurance. The U.S. International Development Finance Corporation has talked about how it is moving towards working with private insurance providers to insure about $40 billion worth of ships. But that's actually like a drop in the bucket, because in the early part of the war, JP Morgan estimated that the actual amount needed for ships that are in the Gulf is, as a minimum, is $352 billion. So this would be 10% of the